EU ministers agree to more sanctions aimed at strangling Russia's economy over its continued invasion of Ukraine.
We are all victims of Russia's aggression, and therefore it is crucial that we keep on aiding Ukraine.
Plus, ahead of their one-on-one debate this week, how President Biden and his re-election challenger Donald Trump differ on support for Ukraine.
Differences over Ukraine reflect their differing approaches to Russia, with Trump looking to improve ties with Moscow and Biden continuing to isolate Russia over its invasion of Ukraine.
And later in the program, how modern understanding of a phenomenon at ancient Mayan ruins in Mexico is rooted in the work of a Ukrainian-born academic. Today is Monday, June 24th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Lori London. Ukraine's major cities, including the capital of Kyiv, endure yet another string of Russian missile strikes over the weekend and into Monday. The attacks led to multiple deaths and injury, along with destruction and damage again to Ukraine's power infrastructure. Anna Chernikova in Kyiv joins us now for an update.
So it was quite a tough weekend for Ukraine, and particularly the city of Kyiv and Kyiv region and the city of Kharkiv. These two regions were under a pretty bad Russian attacks with the use of ballistic missiles, the Kalibr missiles. The Kyiv region was attacked with three missiles, and just two were destroyed. So one hit was reported. However, there are no details of what facility was hit. But according to what we're hearing here, that a certain military facility was under attack. The city of Kharkiv suffered even worse attack. There were two attacks over the weekend. The first attack of the city of Kharkiv caused at least 56 people injured and at least two people killed. At least this is the latest information that we have at this point. Unfortunately, the number could change.
What kind of damage was incurred in Kharkiv over the weekend? Were there any specific targets?
Mainly, Russian forces targeted the residential areas in the city of Kharkiv. The first attack caused quite a severe damage and some of the civil infrastructure across the city. The second attack caused the damage of, unfortunately, the damage of one of the medical institutions as well as also residential area. At least 12 people were reported injured as a result of the second attack, and also the city of Kharkiv suffered electricity shutdown. President Zelensky reported that over the weekend the electricity was returned to the city of Kharkiv, but still people are remaining in the hospital.
And apparently the attacks didn't stop over the weekend. They've been continuing into Monday.
Yes, you're absolutely right. On Monday, the city of Odessa was under attack. In the morning local time, Odessa was hit as well by the Russian missiles. And at this point, what we know is that the main target was one of the storage facilities in the city of Odessa. According to the owner of this facility and workers of this facility, it was the second attack. However, according again to the information that we have, this storage did not store any military-related items. However, as we see, Russian forces target not just military facilities, but also the agricultural storages, and especially if we're talking about Odessa. And this is probably one of the case this time. However, again, we don't have really particular details of what exactly the place is. We know that there are some people injured. However, at least at this point, no casualties were reported.
Such a difficult situation across Ukraine. I understand the first EU portion of frozen Russian assets are expected to be arriving on Monday. What can you tell us about that? Is it in the form of weapons or finances?
As we already discussed, EU recently approved the transfer of Russian frozen assets to Ukraine for Ukrainian aid. And just on Monday, Ukraine is expecting to receive the first tranche from the EU. And this tranche would be in the amount of up to 1.4 billion euros from the frozen Russian assets. And this money, according to the preliminary information, will be used to purchase of ammunition and air defense systems for Ukraine, as well as to buy certain ammunition production directly from the Ukrainian industry companies.
Anna Chernikova reporting for us from Kyiv. Thank you, as always, so much.
Thank you, Laurie.
The European Union's 27 members are stepping up efforts to punish Russia over its continuing invasion of Ukraine. As Associated Press correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports, EU foreign ministers meeting in Luxembourg Monday approved a fresh round of sanctions against the Kremlin.
Before the meeting, Finland Foreign Affairs Minister Elina Valtonen says pressure must be maintained on Russia.
We are all victims of Russia's aggression, and therefore it is crucial that we keep on aiding Ukraine, because Russia only understands power.
The EU on Monday slapped new sanctions on Moscow over its war in Ukraine, targeting the nation's shadow fleet of tankers moving liquefied natural gas through Europe. Valtonen hopes these measures will have an impact.
I appreciate the 14th sanctions package and also the steps we are going to take to make the use of the shadow fleet by Russia.
I'm Charles de Ledesma.
The death toll from a series of brazen attacks on churches and synagogues in Russia's mainly Muslim region of Dagestan rose to 20 on Monday after gunmen went on a rampage and coordinated attacks in two of the republic's most important cities. Security analyst Harold Chambers tells the Associated Press that Russia may well fear the terrorist threat inside the country will intensify.
We've seen an uptick in Dagestan specifically today as a result of the authorities' distraction by the looming specter of Ukrainian sympathizers, this continuous tightening repression, particularly in the wake of large-scale anti-mobilization protests in September of 2022.
He suggests there was a disconnect between Russian counterterrorism capability and terrorist capability inside Russia.
The authorities' response initially was significantly more than we have seen in the past, but still lacking, particularly with response time. They were definitely caught off guard.
The Kremlin has not commented on who was to blame or why authorities failed to stop them. U.S. presidential candidates Joe Biden and Donald Trump meet Thursday for their first debate ahead of the November election. War in Ukraine is expected to be one of the top foreign policy questions. VOA's Tatiana Voroshko looks at how the two candidates differ in their approach to Ukraine.
Joe Biden and Donald Trump both agree on the need to end the war in Ukraine, though foreign policy experts say Trump has been less specific about how to make that happen between Russian leader Vladimir Putin and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Sergey Kudelya is an associate professor of political science at Baylor University.
He advocated only for the need to start some types of talks or negotiations, and he said that he would be willing to engage in these negotiations between Putin and Zelensky, but he never expressed any or specified any of the designs or the future outline of this peace agreement.
In this year's congressional fight to pass Ukraine aid, Trump said that assistance should be loans and not grants.
We're thinking about making it in the form of a loan instead of just a gift. We keep handing out gifts of billions and billions of dollars.
Trump says Europe should pay a greater share of helping Ukraine. But if reelected, Trump will not want to be seen as having lost that war, says former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine John Herbst.
We do know that Trump perceives himself as a strong man, does not want to be associated with foreign policy failure. And a Russian victory in Ukraine, if Trump is president, would look very much like a foreign policy failure.
Trump's Republican Party is split over Ukraine, with some leaders viewing the war as a major U.S. security threat, and others saying it is a costly distraction.
Russia, for many of members of the Republican foreign policy establishment, is viewed as a declining power, and hence the Russian-Ukrainian war, from their standpoint, is a conflict that needs to be settled as quickly as possible, so that it does not drain the security resources of the United States.
As president, Biden leads the international coalition coordinating military assistance to Ukraine with more than $175 billion in U.S. aid. He says America will stand against unjust and unprovoked aggression for as long as it takes.
If the United States walks away, it will put Ukraine at risk. Europe is at risk. The free world will be at risk, emboldening others to do what they wish to do us harm.
Biden has partially removed restrictions on Ukraine using U.S. weapons against military targets in Russia. That commitment means the policy of a second Biden term would likely mirror the first, with greater latitude for increasing economic pressure on Russia, says Catholic University of America professor Michael Kimmage.
It's not as if they're determining their foreign policy on the basis of the election in some crude fashion, but there are limits and constraints, and those would be very different in a second term where, you know, Biden can no longer run for re-election in 2028, and so he would be quite a bit freer.
The candidates' differences over Ukraine reflect their differing approaches to Russia, with Trump looking to improve ties with Moscow and Biden continuing to isolate Russia over its invasion of Ukraine. Tatiana Voroshko, VOA News, Washington.
And just in, VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb is reporting the U.S. is expected to announce more military aid this week for Ukraine, valued at $150 million. The government of Georgia has taken a sharp turn toward Russia, according to its critics, who warn that the country's democratic future is at stake in elections due in October this year. As Henry Ridgewell reports from Tbilisi, the European Union granted official candidate status to Georgia last year, but analysts say the government has taken a change of political direction following Russia's 2022 invasion of Ukraine, led by the country's richest man.
Georgians call it the Glass Castle, a $50 million mansion overlooking Tbilisi with a shark tank and helipad. It's home to billionaire Bidzina Ivanishvili, Georgia's richest oligarch and founder of the ruling Georgian Dream Party. Eka Gigauri is the head of the anti-corruption organization Transparency International Georgia.
Ivanishvili is the real ruler of this country. So he owns one-third of Georgian GDP and he made his fortune in Russia in the late 90s. So he still has the interest in Russia through his offshore companies, and not only him, but his family members as well. Is it possible to expect, or is it realistic to expect from such individual that he will do everything for Georgia to become the EU and NATO member? I don't think so.
That battle for Georgia's future as part of the West or in Russia's geopolitical orbit is being played out on the streets of Tbilisi. A so-called foreign agent law, like the one in Russia, has galvanized the opposition ahead of October elections. Anti-government protesters show solidarity with Ukraine in its fight against Russian domination. The protests have forced Ivanishvili into the limelight. At a pro-government rally in April, he said a Western global party of war was meddling in Georgia. Political analyst Gia Nodia of Ilya State University.
Russian invasion of Ukraine somehow put him on the spot that he had to take sides more clearly, and he did not want to, but eventually he moved more in Russian direction, even though Georgian Dream tries to hide it, not to say it openly. Ivanishvili made a strategic decision that Russia is winning this war, so we should stay with the winner, prospective winner as he saw it.
Among them is Aka Zarqua of the Governance Monitoring Center, a non-governmental organization that monitors government campaigns. Critics say the Georgian Dream Party is exploiting people's fears.
Their propaganda, main propaganda line right now is that if we are out of power, so war with Russia is inevitable. They're trying to portray West and Western countries, especially United States and European Union, as an some kind of enemy of Georgian traditional interests, to say, and family family values.
Government supporters deny such accusations. Fridon Ingier is a pro-government MP with the European Socialist Party.
The main goal of the Georgian government now is to maintain peace.
The opposition says the West should have been wiser to Georgian dreams' true loyalties. Giga Bokeria is chairman of the European Georgia Party.
So it's lack of focus, lack of attention, and overall misunderstanding that what's going on in Georgia is part of this bigger confrontation with Russia.
Analysts say the foreign agent law has politicized younger generations who are determined to force a change of government at the October elections. Others caution that Ivanishvili is a shrewd political operator who won't relinquish power without a fight. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News, Tbilisi.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Lori London. June 20th marked the start of the summer solstice, a moment that draws thousands of people from around the world to the ancient Mayan ruins at Chichen Itza, Mexico, to see a phenomenon that appears each year, a sun shadow of a serpent descending from the top of the site's main pyramid. And what many visitors do not know is that much of the modern understanding of the ancient Mayans is rooted in the work of a Ukrainian-born academic from the Soviet era. Marcus Harton narrates this report from the VOA Moscow Bureau.
Chichen Itza is one of the most visited archaeological sites in the world, with visitors getting explanations of ancient Mayan culture that to this day remains much of a mystery. What is known is largely the result of the work of Yuri Konorozov, a Ukrainian-born Russian academic who is credited with deciphering the Mayan code. Far from Mexico, Konorozov, a young student at the University of Moscow after the end of World War II, came across the work of a German scientist who labeled the deciphering of Mayan hieroglyphs an unsolvable problem. Konorozov, who died in 1999, took it on as a personal, lifelong challenge. It was an especially difficult one. The Cold War was at its peak, and the Soviet Stalinist regime prohibited him from traveling or interacting with Western scientists. One of his students, Margarita Albadil, now a researcher at Peter the Great Museum of Anthropology and Ethnography in St. Petersburg, says Konorozov was penalized for actions that were beyond his control during World War II. She says he was invited to do research, but this door was slammed on him because during the war, his family stayed in the territory occupied by Germans. And in Stalin's time, that meant an indelible stain on his record. Konorozov figured out that each of the symbols in Mayan scripts stood for a syllable, 355 characters in all, with no computer. He wrote everything by hand. His work, though initially challenged by world academics at the time, has since been validated and accepted by leading researchers, including in the United States, who say Konorozov made possible the modern decipherment of Mayan hieroglyphic writing. At Moscow's Konorozov Center for Mesoamerican Studies, today, the culture of North America's pre-Columbian civilizations fascinates many. One of the professors at the center, Galina Ershova, was also a student of Konorozov.
She
says they have worked considerably to make Konorozov's achievements known, because what he did was more important than what others did. It wasn't until the last years of his life in the 1990s, after the collapse of communism and Soviet rule, that Konorozov was able to visit the Mayan ruins at Palenque in Mexico. The Mexican government honored him with the highest decoration it gives to foreigners, the Order of the Aztec Eagle. The medal is today guarded affectionately by his granddaughter, Anna Maslova. She says Yuri Konorozov was not just a remarkable grandfather. He is the most significant, the most beloved person in her life. They thought alike. He paid all his attention to her when he was not busy with his science. To be short, she says, she wishes everyone could have such a grandfather. Konorzov is largely forgotten in Russia, but his work in deciphering an ancient mystery, all done from the confines of his desk and under the political repression of his time, outlives him. For Olga Pavlova in Moscow, Marcus Harton, VOA News.
And finally, the United Nations estimates about 6.5 million Ukrainians have fled the country since Russia's invasion in 2022, many of them families with school-age children. VOA's Kane Farabaugh explores the story of one Ukrainian teenager seeking safety in music in the U.S. city of Chicago.
16-year-old Sophia Balan has played the viola since the age of six.
Viola is so important for me because it's part of me and of my life.
A life mostly centered around her eastern Ukrainian village in the Chernihiv region, not far from the border with Russia. A life filled with family, friends, and music. A life shattered when Russian tanks rolled by her home in February 2022.
It was terrible. I'm just scared of shelling, bombing, everything.
The music from her viola that once filled her life with joy faded amid dwindling opportunities to practice and play.
Because when we were occupied, I played not very often.
As the war dragged on, Sophia's parents realized she would need to flee the country to have some kind of meaningful future. That meant Sophia's mother, Oksana, would have to leave her husband behind in Ukraine, where men are needed to fight the war.
Almost all the way. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Every day, someone died in the front line. Someone's brother or father or son. And it's so terrible. I want for her to have a choice, to have possible to get a good education and make her own decision what to do. Not what they left for Ukrainian children in Ukraine.
Oksana succeeded in finding a program enabling them to resettle in the United States. They made the difficult journey from Ukraine to Chicago in November 2022.
It's like a trip to space because you don't know what is there, how it would be.
They arrived with a pair of suitcases and Sophia's precious viola. Since their arrival, the Balans have found an apartment, and Oksana has found a job. But most importantly for Sophia,
can you start again?
The air is once again filled with the music of her viola.
Music fills her soul.
Stephen Gooden is the conductor of the Merritt Philharmonic Orchestra at Chicago's Merritt School of Music, where 2 years after Russian tanks interrupted Sophia Balan's life, she is now not just learning, but playing her viola in front of audiences.
And when you see her eyes light up when she's performing and her body move while she's playing, or we're in rehearsal and something was really special, or we're sure the recording, any of those kinds of things, you talk to her, like, she really feels like she belongs here. And I don't think there could be anything more special.
It's something that calms me down. I switch my attention from that thing I've been worrying about and focus on the moment to play my best. It calms me down.
While Sophia is fulfilling the reasons that motivated her mother Oksana to leave their lives in Ukraine behind, Chicago and the Merritt School of Music are only stops on her journey to eventually return to Ukraine.
Because it's my motherland, where I was born and grown up.
Bum, 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 where?
And where she resolves to one day join the fight against the Russians with her viola at her side.
Is it possible to carry a viola and a machine gun at the same time?
Totally try.
Says yes, of course.
Kane Farabaugh, VOA News, Chicago.
And that'll do it for us today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day at voanews.com. And on social media, just follow VOA News. On behalf of all of us here at VOA, thank you so much for listening. Until next time, I'm Lori London.